Hello again, everyone, wherever you may be, and welcome to the 140th edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good to be here, Dennis.
Laura, if anyone in the listening universe doubts that we are up to the moment when we go on the air live on these Monday nights, here is proof. Until 45 minutes ago, we were going to start tonight with word on the federal government shutdown that was averted this past Saturday, just in the nick of time. But we have breaking news to report at 7:01 Central Time, and that news is Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz has just introduced a motion to remove House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, from his leadership position. The House is going to have 48 hours to vote on it. Laura, this is taking place because Kevin McCarthy worked to avert the shutdown on Saturday.
That's right. I mean, last week there was a lot of drama in the House, and a lot of Republicans were saying there's no way that they would vote for a continuing spending resolution that kept spending levels the same. And of course, that ended up being what happened. And so the rebels in the House Republican caucus are very upset about it. And it's anyone's guess what's going to happen. But one thing I can assure you is that Iowa's four U.S. House Republicans will be loyal to Kevin McCarthy throughout any votes that come up on his speakership.
It is highly unlikely that Gaetz has the votes in the Republican caucus to remove McCarthy, but he doesn't need all those votes. He just needs to peel away five or six in order to remove him from the speakership, unless the Democrats help McCarthy. Will Democrats jump in to help Kevin McCarthy?
What I've been reading is that Democrats plan to vote present, which in a way would be helping McCarthy. I mean, he can only afford to lose, I think, four votes now. One of the Republican members of the House resigned and has not been replaced yet. So he's got an even smaller majority, and he just doesn't have a lot of room. And I don't think that Democrats want to vote for Kevin McCarthy. I think a lot of Democrats are very upset over the way negotiations were handled. On the other hand, I mean, I think they're just happy to watch the chaos unfold on the other side. Remember, the Republican majority now is basically the same as what the Democratic House majority was for the first 2 years of the Biden administration. And Democrats love reminding reporters that you didn't see this kind of drama under Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
All right, let's talk about what happened on Saturday and Saturday night to keep the government open. It was a stopgap temporary measure, spending measure. It passed the House on Saturday afternoon with plenty of Democratic support and some Republican support, and then the Senate on Saturday night. How did this come about?
So last week, there was a lot of maneuvering, and Kevin McCarthy was trying to figure out a strategy. What the Republicans agreed to a deal with President Biden several months ago to keep spending at 2023 levels as part of the deal to avert the debt ceiling. The cliffhanger there over the debt ceiling. And then a lot of people in the Republican caucus wanted to bring spending down more significantly. So last week, Kevin McCarthy spent some time bringing up individual spending bills covering various government departments to the floor. They brought four to the floor, three of those passed, the fourth one didn't. And then when it seemed like things were almost down to the wire, Kevin McCarthy introduced a continuing spending resolution that would have had very significant cuts to domestic programs. I mean, it would have kept defense spending, homeland security the same, but most other programs would have been cut by about 30%. And that failed because some of the Republican hardliners voted against it along with all of the Democrats. And so then, as of Friday night, all of the congressional reporters I follow said, well, they just didn't even see any way that a shutdown could be avoided. But Kevin McCarthy ended up coming around on Saturday to the deal that he had been saying he would never make. He agreed to a continuing spending resolution. It keeps the government funded at current levels until November 17th. And so no new money for the border security, no huge cuts to domestic spending. And then we're probably headed for another showdown in mid-November.
The vote in the House was 335 to 91 in favor. 209 Democrats voted in favor of the bill, along with 126 Republicans. Then the Senate on Saturday night, with a couple of hours to spare, voted 88 to 9 to approve that measure. Now, here's the interesting thing. Every member, all of them, of Iowa's all Republican Senate and House delegation voted in favor of the stopgap funding measure.
Yes. And even though several of the Iowa House Republicans had said in recent public comments that they wanted to see spending cuts. In fact, Zach Nunn of the 3rd Congressional District told reporters last week that there was no way that anyone was that that any continuing resolution that kept spending constant was going to pass. We're going to need to have deep cuts. And he and the other Iowans in the U.S. House, they all did vote for that bill that Kevin McCarthy brought to the floor on Friday, the one that didn't pass, that contained pretty significant spending cuts. But when that didn't go forward, they all fell in line on Saturday to pass this continuing resolution, but they weren't happy about it. And I mean, I think that in November, they're going to be looking to get something different from the status quo in exchange for keeping the government open. But we did see all of the Republicans in the U.S. House from Iowa wanted to make sure everybody knew that they did not support a government shutdown.
So the measure does not include more money for Ukraine, and that could spell long-term trouble for that country.
Yes, and that was a surprise to me to see the Republicans from Iowa. In the past, Iowa's Republican delegation has been very supportive of aid to Ukraine. In 2022, when various measures came before the House and the Senate, all of the Iowans always voted for it. But when there was a separate vote over an amendment this week on one of the defense funding bills, a separate vote on Ukraine, all four of the Iowans voted against additional U.S. money to Ukraine. And that was a big surprise to me, especially for Zach Nunn, because he has talked in the past about how he served in Ukraine. He spent time there as an election observer. He has strongly condemned the Russian invasion. So this, I thought this was something very new to see the Iowa Republicans in the House, at least, reluctant to commit more U.S. funding to Ukraine.
Okay, we are limited time tonight because we have so much to talk about. Let's move on to that GOP presidential debate last Wednesday night in Simi Valley. Eight candidates were qualified to be there. Trump was one of them. He did not show up. The seven who showed up, oh, Laura, it was a battle royal, screaming, yelling, people talking over the top of each other, personal attacks, the moderators failing to keep control. It was a mess of a debate.
It was even a bigger mess than the first debate, which I didn't think was well managed at all. I mean, I think one of the problems was, as we discussed, the first debate, the moderators lost control early, and the candidates who barged in and interrupted ended up getting more speaking time. And so what you saw in the second debate is basically everybody said, well, I'm going to barge in and interrupt because that's the only way I'm going to get a share of the spotlight. And there was just the moderators just did, they were so ineffective. And also in this kind of a setting, I think it's really important when you have a live audience to tell the live audience not to make a lot of noise with applauding. That just eats into the time. It makes it difficult sometimes to hear the candidates. And so really just everything about it from top to bottom was poorly managed.
We are going to briefly talk about what each candidate said. And I really do mean briefly. Ron DeSantis, he's second in the polls to Donald Trump. He said he would sign a federal 15-week abortion ban. He also called out Donald Trump, saying he should be on stage to defend his record.
That's right. This was the most direct criticism we've seen from Ron DeSantis of Donald Trump in this kind of setting. In the past, he's shied away from publicly criticizing Trump, and he's made some comments to reporters, but not like that on camera. I will say that in the post-debate polling that I saw and focus groups, it seemed like DeSantis did better than anybody else who was up there on the stage, but I didn't see evidence that a lot of minds were changed.
Nikki Haley was far, far more aggressive than she was in the first debate. She got into arguments with South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, with Vivek Ramaswamy. She argued with Scott over who has the better experience in South Carolina. She asked him, 12 years, where have you been? They drowned out each other in argument, and then it went on.
Yes. I mean, Nikki Haley, I think right now the latest South Carolina polling shows that she is doing better than Tim Scott. And I think for someone like Nikki Haley, I mean, she's not going to win the Iowa caucuses. The goal is to finish in the top three. If she can finish in the top three in Iowa and New Hampshire, then South Carolina comes and she's going to be hoping that she can build some momentum there. She did have one of the highlight moments from the debate when she called out Vivek Ramaswamy and said, every time I hear you, I feel a little dumber for what you say. And I think that got a big reaction from the audience because many people see Ramaswamy as kind of having a know-it-all demeanor.
Yeah, and that came when he and Haley were getting into a verbal fight over Russia's war against Ukraine. He said, and I'm quoting, just because Putin's a dictator doesn't mean that Ukraine is good. Haley interrupted him saying a win for Russia is a win for China, but I forgot you like China.
Yeah. I mean, Ramaswamy has been the most vocal in this field about saying that the U.S. should stop supporting Ukraine, that basically we should let Russia take control of at least part, if not all, of Ukraine, and that somehow He has an idea that this would be something that would drive Russia apart from China, and that our current policy is driving Russia toward China. I have not read anybody in the foreign policy community who agrees with that, so I'm not really sure where he's getting it. But there certainly is a sentiment within the Republican base. There are people who think that we shouldn't be spending this money on Ukraine, and so he's trying to tap into that.
Tim Scott was much more assertive and present than in the first debate. He criticized Ramaswamy over business in China. And of course, Tim got into that war of words with Nikki.
He did, although what I saw as in both the focus groups and the post-debate polling, there was a poll by Ipsos and ABC, and they did not show that a lot of people thought that Tim Scott won the debate. I mean, he didn't do terribly, but DeSantis had the highest ratings, followed by Haley and Ramaswamy.
And then there were the others, Mike Pence, Chris Christie, Doug Burgum. They were almost left out, almost. Well, they were there. They were speaking, but it doesn't appear that they made much of an impression.
No, and the reaction from Republican voters who watched the debate was very negative. And sometimes it's hard to interpret these post-debate snap polls and focus groups because people might be taking in their pre-existing opinions about the candidates. I mean, we know that both Chris Christie and Mike Pence have very high unfavorable ratings with Republican voters, basically because of either their public criticism of Trump, or in the case of Pence, the perception that he didn't help Trump on January 6th. And so I think that's difficult to overcome. I mean, they're not going to look at anything and say that they made an effective case during the debate.
Just a minor aspect of this, who got the most speaking time at the debate? Well, Ron DeSantis did at 12 and a half minutes. Doug Burgum had complained that he wasn't being asked any questions. Well, he was only on for 7.5 minutes. He really wasn't.
Yeah. And I mean, it's really hard for him to remain relevant. And I think that I don't think they've announced the qualifying criteria for the third debate, which is going to be in November. But I think it's very possible that Doug Burgum is not going to qualify for that debate.
And as we said, the former president was not at the debate. Mr. Trump instead was near Detroit talking to non-union members and some union members. He was there after President Biden had gone to Detroit to talk to striking auto workers on the picket line. It was a strange couple of days there.
Yes. And I noticed that during Donald Trump's rally in Ottumwa yesterday, he went off on a little riff about how the debate had the lowest ratings ever. Just terrible. Just nobody was interested in watching. So he's definitely not going to be participating in any of these debates.
No. The next one is November 8th in Miami. We'll keep you advised on that one. Meanwhile, there's another interesting debate going to take place November 30th, and a lot of people may want to watch this one. It's going to be between Governor Gavin Newsom of California and Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. They're holding their own personal debate.
Yeah, well, the Fox News Channel is hosting this, and it's a little bit strange, right? I mean, it does seem like a big tip of the hat from Fox to Ron DeSantis, because who really benefits from this? I mean, DeSantis is the one who will get a showcase. And I guess a lot of people would see this as a possible preview of the 2028 presidential election.
Right. All right. There are some other things briefly to talk about related to candidates. Former President Donald Trump's fraud trial. This is unrelated to any other indictments. His fraud trial began on Monday in Manhattan. He's accused of overvaluing his holdings.
Yes, and there was a ruling last week that was pretty favorable to the New York Attorney General that on summary judgment, many of the claims were decided on summary judgment in this favor of the state of New York, that basically that the judge deemed that there really wasn't any way that Donald Trump could prove his case. And also, it is going to be a bench trial, not a jury trial. It appears that Donald Trump's attorney for this case did not act within a certain time frame of requesting a jury trial. Of course, for Donald Trump, I think a jury trial is going to be very important, because all you need is one person on your side to hang a jury.
And one more note, while all of this was going on, House Republicans held their first hearing last Thursday as part of that inquiry into whether to impeach President Biden.
Yes, it didn't seem to go very well. And I even saw one of the congressional reporters was saying that many Republicans were angry after the hearing. The Republicans who organized this, James Comer is the committee chair who organized the hearing, and he had three witnesses, and two of them basically said that they didn't see enough evidence right now to justify articles of impeachment against Joe Biden. So some Republicans were even talking about perhaps moving this impeachment inquiry into the Judiciary Committee, where it would be presided over by Jim Jordan, theoretically.
It is 15 after the hour exactly. And this is KHOI's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. We are here every week this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capitol and what it all means. And we have so much to talk about tonight, including the death of a major United States senator. Dianne Feinstein, longtime senator from California, Democratic senator, passed away. She had been ill for a number of years. She was 90 years old, the Senate's oldest member. The oldest member is now Chuck Grassley. She had appeared frail in recent months using a wheelchair. She had a heck of a career.
She did. I mean, she was, along with Barbara Boxer, she was one of the first two women to represent California in the U.S. Senate. She came to national prominence when she became mayor of San Francisco after a horrific assassination of the mayor and Harvey Milk, who was the first openly gay supervisor in the city. And one of the things that that experience left her with was she was very committed to reducing gun violence. And that was something that she worked on for many years in the Senate. The assault weapons ban, for instance, was something that she had quite a hand in.
I will never forget that day in November of 1978 when Dan White went and killed Mayor George Moscone and Harvey Milk. All of us were in the newsroom in Central California in Fresno watching a live feed out of San Francisco where Dianne Feinstein, the president of the Board of Supervisors, had to make the announcement that those two, Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk, had been killed. Gasps went up from all the reporters in San Francisco, all of us in the newsroom. It was so shocking that that could take place. It was an indelible memory for any one of us who was watching that.
Yes, it was. And she, people forget this now, but California, really, Republicans did quite well in California for many years. And Dianne Feinstein was part of the process of turning California from a purple state to a blue state. And that was something that I think will be part of her legacy.
So both President Biden and Senator Grassley of Iowa had nice things to say about her.
Yes, I mean, they did. And Chuck Grassley worked closely with her because for a period of time when he was the chair of the Judiciary Committee, she was the ranking member. And he was very gracious about how she had conducted herself. President Biden also talked about how she was pioneering in many ways. I wanted to say one thing. Chuck Grassley mentioned that Dianne Feinstein did a lot of work on the International Narcotics Council. That was something that an issue that he said that he worked closely with her on. And another thing that she will be remembered for is that she was very instrumental in getting a report, a public report on torture by the CIA and torture in Iraq after the Bush administration. That was something that she worked very hard on as well.
I covered Dianne Feinstein many times in person here in the Valley. She was always a gracious and literate interview, and she was a centrist Democrat in California as California increasingly went farther left. And she's going to be missed out here. And Governor Newsom announced her replacement on Sunday night. It was way, way out. No one had this person on his replacement list, not the LA Times, the Washington Post, New York Times, or Dennis Hart. He chose LaFonza Butler, a Democratic strategist, very prominent in the labor movement. She is the president of Emily's List. She cuts across a number of things that the governor wanted to have in terms of an appointment. She is Black. She is a gay woman. And she is, I think, an inspired appointment by Governor Gavin Newsom.
Yes, and she's close to Vice President Kamala Harris. I think that was a factor. I think one reason she wasn't on anybody's radar is I believe that in recent documents, she has listed an address in Silver Spring, Maryland. So, I mean, I saw that Gavin Newsom had indicated that he was inclined to appoint a Black woman if there was a vacancy. And but so many people thought it might be Barbara Lee, a U.S. House member who is one of the Democrats running for Senate, because Dianne Feinstein had already announced that she didn't plan to run for re-election next year. But and then many of the other prominent Black women in California politics had already endorsed Barbara Lee's campaign. So who is he going to pick? And like you said, LaFonza Butler, I didn't see that name. I didn't see any speculation about her prior to that news breaking last night.
I was surprised last night, but it makes complete sense. We should say very quickly that Barbara Lee, Adam Schiff, and Katie Porter have already announced they're running for Senator Feinstein's seat. She had announced she would not run for re-election next year. And Gavin Newsom had always said he does not want to put his thumb in favor of anybody who's running for that election. That's why he did not appoint Barbara Lee, because she's running.
Yes, I think that that is the main reason he did not appoint Barbara Lee.
So she is expected to be sworn in, LaFonza Butler, I hear now, tomorrow, Tuesday, not Wednesday, as we had originally heard. So we will report on that next week.
And by the way, in case there was some speculation last week that Senate Republicans might not allow Dianne Feinstein to be replaced on the committee she served on. Of course, that would be very important on the Judiciary Committee. But in fact, that was not the case. Very soon after Feinstein's passing was announced, Republicans in the Senate said that, yes, they will allow Democrats to appoint replacements on committees.
Believe it or not, we have more tonight. Capitol Week's Caucus Almanac. After the debates last week, Nikki Haley came to Iowa on Saturday to Clive. Donald Trump came to Ottumwa on Sunday. Mr. Trump had the more, shall we say, he had a bigger crowd. He was more out there, as he always is.
I think we're going to see Nikki Haley. She's already been doing a lot of events in the suburbs, and I think we're going to continue to see that. The suburban, somewhat more moderate Republican voters, especially Republican women, that is going to be a very solid target audience for Nikki Haley. And I think it's very important. As I mentioned, I think that her realistic goal is to finish in the top three in Iowa. And I think that to do that, she will need to do very well in the suburban areas. And so I think that is what we're going to see. I noticed that Donald Trump has apparently started referring to her as bird brain. You know, he likes to apply these degrading, insulting nicknames to people. And I have to say that I think that's going to backfire. I mean, especially with women voters, that's not going to go over very well. And Nikki Haley, it seems that her campaign is pretty strategically targeting Republican women.
And Trump was targeting farmers. He met with them. He shook their hands, and they seemed to really love him in Ottumwa. And he also got all worked up about electric vehicles, wondering whether a boat with electric batteries would electrocute him if he sank, and saying if he had to choose between being eaten by a shark or being electrocuted, quote, I will take electrocution every time.
I will say that was the clip that I saw most often on social media, but this has been a while since I've done this. I watched the entire Trump speech, which went for more than an hour, and I watched all of the introductory speeches in Ottumwa before Trump came on stage, and it had been a while since I did that for a Trump rally. And I will tell you, I mean, he does not follow a script. Like many of these candidates, if you watch them speak, they're giving the same stump speech over and over again. They're hitting the same points. And he is just talking off the top of his head. Like you said, he just goes off on a tangent about electric boats. But in the Republican base now, there is a lot of hostility toward electric cars and really anything electric. And so he was tapping into that, and the crowd was responding well. And I think that's why he went off in that direction. I wanted to say something that his campaign is doing this time that is very different from 2015. They seem much more organized in terms of getting people to organize and come to the caucus and bring friends to the caucus. I heard some Republicans in 2016 say that one reason they thought that Ted Cruz was able to beat Donald Trump in the end in those 2016 caucuses is that the Cruz campaign was more effective about getting people to commit to actually going to the caucus. And the speakers who were on stage before Donald Trump, they were very intentional about explaining, here's what you need to do. Make sure you don't have any commitments on Monday night, 7 p.m., January 15th. Try to bring at least three friends. If you can bring 10 friends, that's better. It's really not that hard. I mean, they were just talking about the nuts and bolts of getting people to show up at the caucus. And I think that the Trump campaign realizes that this is key. If Donald Trump can have a convincing victory in Iowa, then basically the nominating process is over.
I've got to get my game face back on. It's good to know that former President Trump will take electrocution every time over being eaten.
By shark.
All right. The Governor Reynolds, she was not asked about sharks versus electrocution, but she promised another round of tax cuts for next year because we have a tremendous budget surplus.
Yes, and this is by design. So Iowa has a state law, longstanding state law, that says the legislature can allocate up to 99% of projected revenues. And it's fairly common for the legislature not to try to go right up to that 99% because revenue estimating is an inexact science, so it could fall short. You don't want to have a shortfall and then have to come back in a special session. So, I mean, it has been common for them to allocate, let's say, like 95% of projected revenues. This this year and last year that the legislature allocated less than 85% of the projected revenue. So by design, it's guaranteed basically there's going to be an extremely large surplus. Then Governor Reynolds and some of the leaders in the legislature say, well, if there's a large surplus, that means we must be overtaxing Iowans and we need to pass more tax cuts. Remember that the tax cuts that were approved in past years, especially the flat tax approved in 2022, that has not fully phased in yet. So they're going to be more likely than not passing another major income tax cut before we have fully seen the effect of the one that they passed in 2022.
Very quickly, how do Democrats ever campaign against tax cuts?
Well, it's very difficult. And the Des Moines Register's polling by Ann Seltzer has shown that when they ask people, well, do you think the property taxes should be cut? Do you think income taxes should be cut? Of course, majorities always say that they would prefer to see tax cuts. I think what Democrats are going to say is that our schools are underfunded, our infrastructure is crumbling, young people don't want to live here because of the lack of amenities, the lack of clean water. And I think that's probably going to be their message next year, that the state needs to be funding these vital services for Iowans.
We have 4 minutes left. Let's see how far we can go here. State officials announced this afternoon that the state of Iowa has agreed to take steps to address decades-long issues in mental health and behavioral health access for Medicaid-eligible children.
And this has just been an issue for so long. The disability community has said that Iowa's services have been very inadequate, especially in the mental health area for children. We've ranked near the bottom for quite some time. So the final settlement is not quite there yet. But the fact that the state of Iowa is not going to fight this anymore, I think is significant. But we'll have to come back in future shows and talk about more of the nuts and bolts.
And Democratic State Auditor Rob Sand made news last week saying Iowa public school spending on administrative costs per pupil has not kept up with inflation.
And the reason why he did this is because there was a bill in the Iowa Senate. It was introduced by Senator Brad Zahn last year that would have capped administrative costs for districts, and it would have also changed the definition of what is an administrative cost that would have made it very difficult for some school districts to make their budgets. This is a bill that it did pass the Iowa Senate. In the House, it just got referred to the Education Committee and died. It never even had a subcommittee hearing in the House. But this is something that the Republican advocates for this bill, mainly Brad Zahn, but also others, had said, look, administrative costs are ballooning and we need to take action. And that's why the state auditor, Rob Sand, undertook this special investigation and said, no, actually, we've seen the administrative costs have increased by about 20% over the last 6 years. But in fact, that's a little bit less than you would expect with inflation. Of course, school districts have been dealing with rising costs, just like everybody else. And school districts also have a lot of fixed costs, especially for personnel, because it's baked into the contracts.
Laura, we have only 2 minutes left. Let's do the report on diversity in Iowa that you weighed in on last week. Iowa's diversity index went up to 31% in 2020 compared to 21% a decade earlier. That's good, but you had some other sides of this.
Yeah, so Iowa still is one of the whitest states in the country, even though the white alone population of Iowa now has dropped to just below 85%. There are still only a handful of states that have a larger share of white only population. And as you say, certain counties in Iowa are much more diverse than others. The Buena Vista County, where Storm Lake is, basically the counties that have meatpacking industries tend to be the more diverse counties. So we have the Storm Lake area, the Sioux City area, that's Woodbury County, Marshalltown area, Muscatine, those are very diverse. But there was another report that came out last week that said Iowa is still near the bottom in terms of racial disparities and incarceration. Iowa was tied for seventh place in that survey. And basically, even though Black people comprise about 4% of Iowa's population, they're about 25% of the incarcerated population. And also, the racial disparity was very high for Iowans of American Indian descent as well. And there are a lot of complex reasons. The ACLU of Iowa and the NAACP Iowa-Nebraska chapter said really at every stage of the process, the criminal justice system favors white defendants over those of other races.
And if you want to read more about this, you have it on Bleeding Heartland.
Yes, I do. I had a link to the entire report and also highlights from the report.
We're just about out of time. What in the world are we looking for this week? We know that Kevin McCarthy's in the dock now in the U.S. House. Wow. We're going to have a lot to report next Monday.
Yes, and the Iowa Utilities Board hearings on the Summit Carbon Solutions proposed CO2 pipeline, a lot of intrigue going on there, and that's something that we should talk about next week as well.
You prefer electrocution or being eaten by a shark?
I think I'm not worried about that electric boat sinking as much as Donald Trump is. I'm not really sure why the electric boat would sink in the first place, causing the battery to electrocute you.
Exactly. We're out of time, and just in time, a reminder that the views and opinions expressed here do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. We're having a fun time right now. Laura and I will be back here in the same time slot next week in our boat. And as usual, we'll talk about everything interesting or important or even entertaining that takes place in and around Iowa politics. As always, we hope you can join us. Have a safe, healthy, and happy week.